from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our opening hour this morning, it's not easy being a student today. The federal student loan interest rate doubled on July 1st. State financial assistance continues to decline and university tuition keeps climbing. Some say that raising tuition enables schools to subsidize low-income students. But critics say this high tuition, high aid model actually ends up hurting students in need. We'll discuss the rising costs of higher education and school loans. That's ahead on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Last week, California Governor Jerry Brown signed a bill making college students from middle-class families eligible for a tuition discount with a sliding scale of up to 40%. Though such financial assistance may not be reliable, it is still good news in the face of tuition increases, which have nearly doubled since 2007. In fact, since 1982, a four-year private college costs overall have gone up 150%, while the figure for four-year public schools for the same period is 250%. And add to these figures astronomical student debt and the recent rise in their interest rates, and the simple fact that the skyrocketing costs for a college education have gone on while the inflation-adjusted income for middle-class families has been largely stagnant, and what you have is a debilitating financial picture for college and university students. What can be done? Well, we want to look at the problem and look at possible solutions in this Forum Hour. Let me tell you who is joining us for the hour. In studio, we want to welcome Debbie Cochran. She's Research Director of the Institute for College Access and Success, a nonprofit research and advocacy group that works to make higher education more available and affordable for people of all backgrounds. Welcome to the program. Good morning.
Good morning.
We also have with us in studio this morning David Alcocer, who is Interim Director with the Student Financial Support Office of the President, University of California. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
Glad to have you here as well. And glad also to have with us Andrew Gillen this morning, who's Research Director with Education Sector. They're a Washington, D.C.-based education policy think tank. And Andrew Gillen joins us from the nation's capital. We welcome you.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Joshua Friedman here with us this morning, normally in D.C., but this morning in New York City, a policy analyst in the Economic Growth Program with the New America Foundation. He wrote an article about high tuition, high aid in the recent Atlantic magazine. And welcome, Joshua Friedman.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you. Actually, let me begin with you because the article in the Atlantic talks about many of the public universities trying to keep tuition down for low-income students while raising it for the rest. And from your perspective, essentially the thesis is they wind up making education less affordable for all. So this means-testing education, as it were, these programs for the poor are, I guess, what are often called, by your perspective, poor programs?
That's correct. Colleges are trying a high-tuition, high-aid model in which you raise tuition for everybody and then discount it for the poor, for low-income students, so that they don't have to pay as much. And this is intuitively appealing for the same reason that means-testing programs like Social Security or Medicare is also appealing. You don't want the rich to get extra benefits if they can pay themselves. The problem is that what we found is that tuition goes up for everybody. The high-tuition, high-aid model is pretty much just high tuition.
Means higher prices for all.
Higher prices for all, which is not what we want if we want to ensure that access is available for all students.
Is this because the tuition goes up faster than the aid that's available?
That's exactly right. The way I see it, and one of my theses is that when the tuition goes up, there's still a budget constraint, and you still have to figure out where you're going to spend your money. And one of the first things to go is the discounts that you promised for low-income students. So while the tuition part definitely goes up, you can start with the discounts, but at some point those lose out.
Andrew Gillen, the education sector, let me bring you into this because aside from Bill Bennett himself, former Secretary of Education, you may be the ranking expert on the Bennett hypothesis, which essentially says all financial aid leads to higher tuition. But there's been some inconsistency on that from your perspective.
Yeah, so the basic idea is that
for some types of aid programs, if you make too much aid available, the colleges will respond by raising their tuition. And the reason they do that is because there's a million and one things that the colleges want to spend money on, whether it's, you know, a new science building or glamorous dorms or whatever. There's a million and one things that they want to spend money on. So when you give them access to a pile of money, a lot of them aren't going to be able to help themselves, but to respond to that. So we've made some improvements from the original Bennett hypothesis. So I don't think all aid programs suffer from this. So for example, Pell Grants, which are typically going to low-income students, you don't really have to worry about that leading to higher tuition because the colleges can't really raise their tuition without pricing those students out of the market. But if you look at the other end of the spectrum, there's something like Grad Plus loans available to graduate students, and those are uncapped. So if the college raises its tuition by $10,000, you're automatically eligible for $10,000 more in Grad Plus loans, and that's a big problem from the Bennett hypothesis perspective.
So from your perspective, the high aid programs and high tuition high aid programs, you can't necessarily say that they don't work across the board.
There are a couple examples of institutions following through with the high tuition, high aid model, but they're very, very rare. So I think what basically happens is that institutions start out with the best of intentions, and they actually do want to do this. So they raise tuition and they end up with a lot more money. But then as soon as they have that money, there's all sorts of competing pressures for what to spend it on. And offering that aid to low-income students doesn't always win that argument.
In fact, when these schools are caught up in competition, it's more apt to go the money's more apt to go for those who have merit as opposed to those who are need-based.
Exactly, because if you can attract kind of better quality students, you're going to move up in the rankings. It'll be easier for you to raise money in the future and attract more students. And there's a lot of other ways that colleges want to spend their money.
And the ideal from your perch is that we need to move more to a low tuition model. Good luck with that, huh? Especially in public universities.
Yeah.
I mean, if you have an answer to that, I'd like to hear, and I'll nominate you for a Pulitzer while we're at it.
Well, I'm working on it.
Andrew Gillen, again, is research director with the Education Sector, Washington, D.C.-based education policy think tank, and Debbie Cochran is a research director with the Institute for College Access and Success. They're a nonprofit research and advocacy group. And Debbie Cochran, well, we need to use tuition to offset costs for all kinds of things, but particularly with respect to these lower and moderate income students who, well, need to get a discount.
Absolutely. I think we need to make sure that particularly for low and middle low income students, that college is affordable. And that includes not just tuition, but also all the other costs of going to college that these students incur, their room and board costs, their transportation, their textbooks. And I think that's one way where these high tuition, high aid models really fall apart, because they focus so much on the tuition aspect of students' total costs that they just neglect these other aspects that students are.
Well, not only the students. I mean, for example, you mentioned healthcare costs or retirement fund costs. I mean, all of these things have to be factored into the full equation. But state funding has declined, and particularly in California, the burden has been on the students, hasn't it?
Absolutely. I think that's the reason why we see student debt increasing as much as it has. We see a disinvestment at the state level, not just in California, but in many, many states. So we see tuition rising at public colleges where the vast majority of students attend school. And we see students and families' incomes not keeping pace with costs. So debt is increasing as a result.
We're on a trajectory almost as if college is only affordable to those who come from, you know, fairly well-to-do families. I mean, it's becoming prohibitive even for middle-class families, isn't it?
Well, I think it makes financial aid all the more important. And I think there's a, certainly without financial aid, you know, only the very wealthy families can really afford to, you know, hand over the cash to go to school without any debt. But I think it is important to differentiate for different types of students. You know, there's the low-income students who, maybe on the margins of going to college at all, they may not be able to go without, strong grant aid programs. Middle-class students will most likely go to college. They might have to borrow to do it, but they're likely going to find a way to go.
There are federal dollars going to for-profit colleges, though, are there not?
there are quite a few federal dollars going to for-profit colleges.
And this gets some people, I mean, it stings particularly people in the public universities, and they feel, well, I mean, I'll ask you, do you think it's wrong?
You know, I wouldn't say that I would that, you know, federal dollars should not go to for-profit universities. I think what we would like to see is more accountability for the federal and state dollars that are going to colleges all around. You know, we've actually seen some significant movement on that front in California in recent years. For the state Cal Grant program, for instance, legislators a couple years ago were considering whether or not to cut grants to students. Instead, they decided to get some savings by restricting access to colleges where students were not likely to be served.
David Ugesser, let me bring you into this. Are federal law and state grants keeping up? Or how far are they lagging, really?
Well, I think you raise a really key point, which is they're not keeping up, which is why the institutional aid that public colleges can provide through some of their tuition dollars is so key. And in fact, there were kind of two things that struck me from reading through the analyses that the other guests had put forward. One is I think it's hard to generalize about the drivers of cost increases across different segments. Public universities are in a very different position from very highly elite privates, from for-profits, from second- or third-tier privates. And looking at institutional financial aid as kind of a smoking gun behind cost increases at all of these is, I think, misplaced attention. The second point is all of these generalizations around a de-emphasis of providing aid to low-income students, of using tuition dollars that were initially earmarked for aid for other purposes are completely untrue in terms of what we have experienced at the University of California. University-provided aid has remained among the very top budget priorities for us over the last decade. When I started around that time ago, our overall budget for institutional aid was maybe around $100 million system-wide. Right now, it's over $600 million just for undergraduates. And California, to its great credit, has been fantastic in continuing to support the Cal Grant program, which fully covers tuition and fees for eligible students, and which this year, for UC students, will present over $600 million of aid. I don't mean to suggest that financing a UC education is easy, but when you look at any outcome measure that's available in terms of trends in the percent of students who borrow, graduation rates, our ability to continue to enroll low-income students and their ability to succeed, the net cost for students over time adjusted for inflation, the situation for now for low-income students is quite similar to what it was a decade ago. We've managed to be able to protect them from the most egregious aspects of the tuition increases.
Yeah, but it's especially a hard time for middle class students from middle class families, despite what I mentioned about Governor Brown's offering this eligibility now. I mean, with cost increases and grants not keeping pace, the fact is tremendous growth in student borrowing, especially from the middle class.
That's correct, although I should tell you that we actually devote a fair amount of our aid, a significant amount, to middle-income students. The Cal Grant program, to its credit, reaches far higher up than the Pell Grant program in terms of the families that it serves. And we tend to serve families with even higher incomes, provided they actually have need. And when we look at, for example, the students in middle-income ranges, families that are earning $80,000, $90,000, $100,000, if they have financial need, they will receive institutional aid. In many cases, $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, far more than the so-called premium that students are paying for financial aid. So, which isn't to say, again, that it isn't hard for certain families. But when we have looked at what the impact would be of essentially eliminating our institutional aid program in order to reduce tuition, the impact would be devastating, not just for low-income families, but for middle-income families who have need and who rely on that to help finance a UC education.
Let me go back, if I may, to Joshua Friedman, again, who's a policy analyst in the Economic Growth Program for the New America Foundation, wrote the article about high tuition, high aid in the Atlantic magazine. And I know, Joshua Friedman, there are, well, thoughts about more radical ways of dealing with this ongoing problem, tuition caps, for example. Any sense of how successful those attempts have been, or is there any motion toward that?
I mean, I think that that is would be a step in the right direction if we could do that. But obviously, that strikes a lot of people as a very radical solution. You can look at The recent Oregon plan that
I was going to mention, that's not so radical. It's a good plan for many people's view.
For many people, it's gotten a lot of very heated responses on both sides.
Let me just outline for listeners what we're talking about. In Oregon, they have tuition free now and are eliminating loans, but they actually contractually have those who are graduating pay back their alma mater after graduation up to 25 years. So that's a plan that's gotten a lot of a lot of approval.
It has in some of the education policy circles, and as well in the legislature, which passed the bill.
But it has to be signed by the governor. Yeah,
it does, but it's just a bill to look at a committee to look at it. It's not at the stage yet of actually being implemented, but it does include a de facto tuition cap.
And that would be a pilot program beginning in 2015, from my understanding. But public state funding, which has decreased far faster than state aid and state grant aid, has been born based on merit. I mean, in terms of remaining stable, hasn't it?
Well, the public aid has gone down. And if you're going to set up a high tuition, high aid system in which you need need-based aid to keep access available for everybody, then if you're diverting funds to merit aid, the need-based aid is going to lose out, and it has. And my colleague Steve Bird has looked at the data there and found that schools across the spectrum, not just specific schools, but schools of all kinds, public, private, two-year, four-year, et cetera, have been diverting their need-based aid to merit aid. And if you're going to set up a system in which you need need-based aid because you have high tuition, having all that funding going to merit aid is not going to work.
And the fact is, David Alcocer, especially at public universities like University of California, you're looking for more out-of-state and foreign student money, and that's where a lot of the capital and revenue is coming in.
Well, the implication that we are using student tuition to increasingly focus on merit-based aid or to attract out-of-state students is, again, completely false. We have not spent an additional nickel of tuition-funded aid on merit-based aid since the enormous increase in aid that I mentioned over the past decade. Every bit of additional tuition revenue that we have spent on aid has been focused on our core mission of preserving access to students at every income level, not to increasing our merit-based aid. It is true that we have increased to some extent recently enrollment of non-resident students, not to displace Californians, but because the state funding for increased California enrollment hasn't been there. But those students do not receive additional amounts or extra amounts of aid funded by California students to help attract them. They, in many cases, face higher costs than California residents. They're expected to foot most of their extra $23,000 in non-resident tuition themselves.
Which is why it's attractive to bring them in under the big tent.
You know, it is one way to get additional revenue, as well as to bring greater diversity in terms of the nationalities, the geographic diversity of the student body. But it is absolutely a way to help subsidize the cost of our core mission, which is to educate California students from the entire socioeconomic spectrum.
Debbie Cochran, is there any real plan to overhaul funding here in California for higher education?
Like in the Oregon model? I would say certainly hope not. And frankly, I'm not sure the middle-class scholarship is as good of news as many people think it is. You know, I think if we are going to overhaul higher education funding, we do need to make a much clearer priority of making it actually affordable, not just the tuition, again, but all of the costs for students to be able to go to college. We need to strengthen the Cal Grant program. I mean, at the same time, the legislature and the governor approved this middle class scholarship program, which, you know, is slated to be about $300 million once it's phased in. They rejected a proposal to roll back a cut that the lowest income Cal Grant recipients saw last year. That would have cost $12 million.
And are we going to see community colleges being pulled out of the federal loan program? That's been in the wind.
No? Yeah, we continue to see community colleges pulling out of the student loan program. And I think, you know, this is the community colleges here in California are primarily.
You have to play by credit card?
Credit card, private student loans, all ways that are less attractive than federal student loans. I mean, I think we're talking about high tuition, high aid, and I think this really comes down to any approach that's really based exclusively on tuition will fall apart when it comes to low-income student college affordability. The California community colleges embody a kind of a low-tuition, low-aid model, and you still see some of those schools on the high net price list. You know, they have some of the highest costs for students at community colleges. It's not because the tuition's high. It's because there isn't enough aid for them.
Again, Debbie Cochran's Research Director with the Institute for College Access and Success. I'm going to give out the phone number now and certainly welcome your phone calls. We're talking about the difficulty of financing a college education. Tuition continues to climb and state financial assistance continues to decline. And some say raising tuition actually enables schools to subsidize low-income students. But many critics say this high tuition, high aid model actually ends up hurting students in need. In fact, Joshua Friedman has written about this in The Atlantic, and he's with us, and we have a whole panel, and we can have you as well. We invite you to join us now at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. Some of you may, in fact, want to talk about the growing cost of higher education, how it's affected you. I'm not only talking about parents who are helping perhaps or trying to help pay, but also students themselves who are trying to pay for their college education. You can join us now again toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us. Our email address is forum@kqed.org, or you can post any questions or comments you might have onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Andrew Gillen, before we go to a break here and before we start bringing in callers, what's the impact of all this massive open online courses in terms of what we're talking about here? I mean, state reduces funding and a lot of people are looking for courses online as opposed to paying tuition or matriculating.
Yeah, so far we haven't seen too much impact, and that's largely because right now these are kind of off to the side. So there are very few schools that will give you credit for one of these online classes. That's starting to change, and as that changes and as the online classes themselves mature and improve over time, I think they really do have the potential to kind of shake up the existing system.
Well, Josh Friedman, I know we have to say goodbye to you, and I thank you for being with us here. But final word from you, if I could get it before we go to the break here, and that is, where do you see this all going?
I mean, I hope that we can have policymakers learn the lessons that high tuition, high aid is not actually good for low-income students, and we want to move to a more universal tuition system. And then the question moves to how can we fund that from state or federal or public sources in a more progressive way that will actually ensure that the funding that comes is helping the students who need it, creating low tuition across the board, not creating adverse effects for families who want to go to college.
Again, Joshua Friedman with us from New York, policy analyst in the Economic Growth Program for the New America Foundation. And you can read his articles online in Atlantic or get the magazine. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
And by the way, you can be with us by going to our Facebook page as well as calling us or the usual ways, emailing us or going to our website. And you can also tweet us. Here's Lo who tweets, where does money from increased tuition go? Does it go to higher wages or pensions, infrastructure, aid? What's the proportional breakdown? Can you help us there, Debbie Cochran?
I would actually love to hear David's response to that. I'm not sure if there is a kind of a public way that we can tell that from available data.
Well, I guess David may have the answer at least on for the UC system, but can you break it down for us?
Well, I can say that the tuition net of the amount that we set aside for financial aid is going directly to offset cuts and really otherwise devastating cuts in state funding for the university's core programs that have affected faculty salaries. They've affected the student-teacher ratio. They've affected our ability to keep up with deferred maintenance. Most of our buildings are now more than 30 years old, and the costs of dealing with those continue to rise. We also have increased pension costs that we're starting to tackle seriously that are leading to higher costs for our workforce. We're one of the larger employers in California, and healthcare costs are affecting us just as they would any other. So it's the usual suspects in terms of the rising costs with the added challenge of huge underfunding in state dollars.
We'll continue. We'll hear from you when we return. And then David Alcacer here with us, Interim Director for Student Financial Support with the Office of the President at UC, and Debbie Cochran from the Institute for College Access and Success. And Andrew Gillen is also going to be with us from Washington, D.C. Stay with us. Research Director for the Education Sector, an education policy think tank. You're listening to Forum on KQED. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the high cost of college education and the difficulties, particularly for low-income and middle-income people in actually attaining a college education as tuition continues to rise and as the difficulty in terms of getting the sorts of grants that once were available and aid continue to be more and more difficult. Let me bring our callers on here. And Jeanette, we begin with you. Welcome, Jeanette.
Hi there.
Hi.
I would like to care to comment on the reasons why the Oregon proposed model wouldn't work, the one where the alma maters have skin in the game and lending the money and acquiring it back over 25 years?
Well, who said that they didn't think that was a very good idea? Was it Andrew Gillen? Was it you?
I didn't say anything, but I wouldn't necessarily support that specific plan.
Because?
And the basic idea, I have two kind of issues with it. The first is that with a plan like that, you're going to suffer from what economists call adverse selection, where students who think that they're going to earn a lot are going to tend to shy away from the program. So you're basically going to concentrate students who don't think they're going to earn a lot, whether that's because they're entering a low-paying profession or just because they're going to go on a couple-year sabbatical and backpack through Europe or something. So you got the adverse selection problem. My issue with the program is actually slightly different, and it's that I would really like for these students to be able to refinance whatever they borrow. So I'm a much bigger fan of income contingent lending, where you pay back based on your income, but it's still a loan, as opposed to, because you can almost think of the Oregon plan as the state is buying an equity share in the student. So they're just going to get 3% of the student's earnings for the next 24 years. Whereas with an income contingent loan, as soon as you pay back however much you borrowed, with the accrued interest, you're done. And what that does is it allows the student to refinance their loan whenever they can find better terms.
Debbie Cochran, want to weigh in here?
Sure. I think it was me who said something negative about it before. I think, I would say I have a lot of concerns about the proposal, both, theoretically and logistically. But I would focus on two primary concerns. One is just who is supporting the cost of college under, currently it's a shared model. We've got the state contributing some money. We've got parents contributing some and students contributing some. This model would shift much more of the burden onto students themselves, not even just the students and parents, but the actual students. And I think that's a real political implication that we need to consider carefully and that has not been widely enough addressed and discussed. The second piece is that it's framed as eliminating the need for students to borrow or eliminating student debt in the more traditional sense. And I think that's just flatly inaccurate. Students will still need to borrow for their books and their transportation, all these other costs. And you're going to see more of the debt that students are taking out shifted onto the lower income students.
Yes, and David Alcazar.
I echo Debbie's concerns. In fact, this proposal is very similar to one that was floated by actually a group of students at UC Riverside last year under the auspices of a group they called Fix UC. And it was very similar. It was a slightly different percent and a different repayment period, but the concept was the same. And we had similar concerns. If you compare that to the current framework, because of the combination of state, federal, and institutional aid, we can cover tuition with grant dollars for needy California residents earning up to $80,000 under this Blue and Gold Opportunity Plan that we have. This model would essentially eliminate the concept of tuition and would eliminate funding for those sorts of aid programs. And instead of having those dollars covered, they would now be subject to a tax, essentially, of 3% of their earnings for the next 20 years, in addition, as Debbie says, to the dollars they're already having to borrow to cover their room and board, their books and supplies, and other of the very substantial costs besides tuition that are just as real.
20 years or 25 years? I think it may be 25 years.
Yeah, 24, yeah. 25 years.
Let me bring another caller on here. And we go to you, Kevin. Thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on Forum.
Hey, good morning. Three quick things that, as a borrower of many years who's followed the student loan issues, three things really need to be done on a federal level that would help all students. When students graduate with different loans from different places, often the best option is to consolidate their loans so they get one payment that's lower than paying a bunch of individual payments that they often have trouble making. But when the loan rates go down, as they do in different times as home mortgages tend to do, the students who consolidate can't change their loan rate. So for me, I'm locked in at a ludicrous 8% when it went much lower. That needs to change. The other thing the feds should change is they should let us borrowers deduct our interest payments over the life of the loan just as home mortgage borrowers can. And the third thing is when students get unemployed after they graduate or for hardship reasons, they can put their loans into deferment. However, the interest continues to accrue, and often the only option for the students when they go back into repayment when they get employed is to what's called capitalize that accrued interest, which can be many thousands of dollars. That adds to the total principal the student now owes. So in my case,
I was just going to ask you, how much of your loan have you paid off?
I started out with $75,000. Now I basically have $140,000, and that's just from capitalization. And so it's been talked about, but no one wants to make the decision to stop the interest from accruing, and that can be done. And now keep in mind that student loan debt is now over $1 trillion, exceeds consumer debt, exceeds home mortgage debt.
I think it exceeds credit card debt. In fact.
Yeah, everyone talks about the need for the United States to be as educated in the world stage and all that, yet they don't allow students to take advantage of rules that, you know, people who buy homes to benefit themselves get. I mean, why don't you put us on the same footing that people who buy homes do, and arguably we contribute a lot better in society by investing in ourselves and bettering the nation with a higher educated group of folks.
I think you raised some good points, Kevin, and I thank you for that, especially about interest accruing and what to do about it. Thank you for those comments. Let me bring another caller on from Norfolk, Virginia. Justin, you're on. Hi.
Hi, good morning. One thing I haven't heard addressed is how international students affect high tuition rates. My father teaches at a large private institution. I go to a private institution. And we both discussed how about 40 to 50% of each of our cohorts are from international students, mainly Asian and Middle East, who are subsidized by large families and governments. And they're willing to pay whatever these private colleges are willing to charge. So you have these skyrocketing tuition rates. And then the international students are willing to pay whatever, and they come in, they get educated, and then they go back to their country, and we lose a significant amount of brain drain, and then we're left with our home students here in the U.S. having to pay skyrocketing tuition rates just to compete with the educational quality. And I'll take my comments off here.
All right, thank you for the comments. David Alcacer, I mean, the real question I think he's asking is how much international students affect the tuition picture.
I wouldn't say that they have an impact in terms of how we set tuition. We set tuition based on what's necessary to cover the costs in light of state funding at the time. And to date, international students reflect overall a relatively small portion of UC students. It's about 4% or so system-wide. And I don't see that dramatically increasing in the future. They do add a great deal in terms of the perspectives they bring. And frankly, you know, we have been quite low in our enrollment of out-of-state students for many, many years compared to other national research universities. And to some degree, I think a moderate increase in the extent we can provide a more cosmopolitan and worldly setting for students benefits all students.
Let me go to some of the listener emails here. And David, you might want to respond to this listener, Christina, who says, I'm 29, about to start at Cal this fall after transferring from a community college. I don't qualify for traditional federal financial aid because I am married, and together with my husband's income make around $35,000 a year. I am only lucky enough to go to Cal because of gift aid from the school, which will also help with books this year. I worry about next year's tuition and whether or not I will get the same amount of gift aid again because I cannot afford the high costs of higher education without such help. I guess she's asking maybe for some reassurance about next year.
Yeah, and I mean, all I can say is, you know, Cal has been really spectacular, as of frankly many of our campuses, in terms of sustaining and even increasing their commitment towards aid. Circumstances might change from year to year, but there are certainly no plans in the works to in any way scale back our commitment to enabling students from every income level to finance a UC education.
I'd like to read some more emails, which expressing some strong and I think heartfelt opinions. A listener from Santa Rosa writes, it's now cheaper to buy a new home than to go to school. What kind of social values does this show? Another listener writes, we live in a crazy country where too many people are unwilling to invest in other people's education, as if we don't pay the price in other ways for the resulting lower levels of education, less disposable income, and decreased productivity, emergency health care, crumbling infrastructure. Another listener puts on our website, I live near a CSU, so I lived at home when I went to school. I don't understand paying tens of thousands of dollars just to move away to get the same education. Two-year colleges work, too. And Dave in San Mateo says, what are the main differences in the tax base now and the 1970s to cause this massive increase in tuition? Andrew Gillen, are we talking about tax base here? We have to?
The level of state funding has gotten a lot of attention in the past few years just because it happened to be going down. And I think that certainly exacerbated the underlying trends that were already in higher education. So we saw tuition going up more than it probably otherwise would have. But I think it's also important to emphasize that tuition was going up even when state appropriations were going up. So there's a bigger story there than just tuition going up because state funding went down. And until we unpack that, we aren't going to be able to keep tuition from increasing even more than it is, or even hopefully decreasing.
And Debbie Cochran, here's a listener, Andrew in San Francisco, says there's a bubble in higher education due to limitless credit available to students. Not all students are cut out to be the classic professionals produced by a university. There are other jobs that have value in society. Better tools need to be provided to students early on to guide them to the correct vocation. I think that's an important point, that not everybody necessarily should be cut out for a college education.
Well, I would say there's a growing awareness that as many people as we can get into some level of post-secondary education, we need to get people, maybe not a bachelor's degree, maybe not a graduate's degree, but maybe a post-secondary credential, a certificate, you know, welding, you know, some sort of medical healthcare related credential. So, you know, it's unclear whether this listener or some people consider that college, but I think when the president talks about getting more adults, all of the adults in the country, to have some sort of post-secondary education, that has to be included as part of the picture.
Another listener, if I may go to you on this, David Alcacer, right? So I just graduated from Berkeley and I have about $70,000 of student loans. They are all government loans, but I can't figure out who and how much to pay. There are three organizations I seem to owe money to, one of them being Fannie Mae. What's the best way to consolidate these loans? You have some sage advice for him, David?
Unfortunately, I don't. What I would recommend, though, is that the person contact the financial aid office at Cal, which is actually very well staffed with experts who know the different strategies that students can take to try to minimize their burdens. To the extent that they are federal loans and can be consolidated and the student become eligible for income-based repayment plans, which have greatly expanded in recent years and which for eligible students can cap a student's payments at a relatively low percentage of their income, that can be hugely effective in helping students who don't have initially high earnings to allow them to manage their debt.
Andrew Gillen, if I go to you with another question from a listener, Karen wants to know, where is all the money from these new tuition increases being spent? As a student in the 90s and a lecturer now, I've seen no increase in the quality of the facilities, the pay to the faculty, or the overall quality of the education, while at the same time I've seen tuition go up 2 to 3 times from when I was a student. Where's the money going? Well, I think it's safe to say, isn't it, Andrew? A lot of it's going into building and maintenance and all that, as well as all the other costs we've covered here, healthcare, et cetera.
Yeah, so I mean,
pensions.
On every campus, it's going to be different. But you hit on one of the big ones, particularly prior to the recession, which was kind of this arms race among campuses to kind of build the biggest and best, whatever it be. So rec centers were kind of scandalous for a while because they were nicer than country clubs essentially on a lot of campuses. But on some other campuses, it might have been administrative bloat. So there's a great book by Benjamin Ginsberg called The Fall of the Faculty, and he documents how a lot of colleges are allowing their administrative apparatus to kind of grow very, very quickly. And that could also eat up a lot of the additional money.
I want to read a few more listener comments and then go to our callers. Jim writes, I've been connected to the College of Marin over the past 20 years. So many students get aid and loans to enter into the most remedial math and English classes, and after a year end up dropping out. Essentially, they're doing high school over again. We need more options for students at the high school level that will give them a trade that can actually be used in the real world. Yeah, there are those who excel when they enter junior college, but frankly, they are the outliers. Wanted to read that comment. Another listener, Edward, says on our website, there seems to be a lack of financial education. Students like myself enroll in undergrad and grad school to meet the American dream without realizing the challenge of paying back major loans. The process for accepting these loans as a naive freshman is too easy. What kinds of things are being done to improve this, and how are colleges helping students become more informed consumers of college education? Some light on that, Debbie Cochran?
Sure. I think a number of the callers and listeners have touched on the issue of education and making wise choices about borrowing. And there frankly has to be better loan counseling in both the front end and the back end of students borrowing. We know that too often students take out loans and they don't know whether they're federal or private loans, or they don't get the type of counseling that they really need to make wise decisions about how much to borrow and when to borrow. So, you know, there's a lot that needs to be done. The Department of Education is working on that, but still much more needs to be done.
And if I could go back to you for a moment, Andrew Gillen, Valerie writes on our website, I'm a parent of three young children and can see how this would be either a disheartening or, with some guidance, a quite helpful conversation. What insight, we hope the latter, by the way, what editorial comment, but what insight, she wants to know, might you have on how much middle class earners between $75,000 and $100,000 annually should save per child per year beginning when the child starts kindergarten? That's a tough question because of inflation and all, but some maybe thoughts from you?
Yeah, that is a really tough question because it does depend on a projection of what college is going to cost, you know, 18 years from now or 15 or however old her children are. What I would advise is to put as much as you can into, say, a 501k savings plan. And that will allow you to help defray a lot of the cost once your children reach age.
Again, Andrew Gillen is Research Director of the Education Sector. Thoughts from you on that, David Alcocer?
I agree that saving early makes a lot of sense. And I think, Andrew, you probably meant a 529K savings plan. Saving early as well as really making sure that as your students are excelling in K through 12, that you sort of keep your eye on the ball in terms of what their expectations are and be realistic about it. There are many families that we encounter who had expected that their students would not have to borrow at all in order to attend a four-year college. And I completely understand that hope. In many cases, that was true 20, 30, 40 years ago. But it's less likely to be the case today. So long as students can make wise decisions about borrowing at manageable levels, helping covering their costs by some reasonable but not overly demanding part-time work while they're enrolled, that's how UC students finance their education.
Yeah, but you know, a lot of people are saving money and then suddenly there's a bust or suddenly there's a lot of layoffs or, you know, some kind of economic setback and you know, they just can't make it.
That's true, although those revised circumstances are taken into account when we evaluate their financial aid need. And in fact, we've had many students who, because of the economic recession, have had a dramatic change in their circumstances from one year to the next. When they indicate that change to the financial aid office, they'll more likely than not qualify for additional financial aid.
Let's bring on more callers. Tom, you're on.
Hi. You know, the policy debate is a little over my head, but I think maybe this story will resonate. My daughter's a musician, and she's got accepted to Harvard. She's going there, and she applied to music conservatories, music schools within universities, and to some Ivy Leagues. And she got some full tuition scholarships from some of the music schools based on merit. But at Harvard, she got and by the way, we're middle class, and she got zero need based aid, no government loans or anything like that on top of the merit scholarships. But at Harvard, she got need-based aid equivalent to full tuition, a bigger dollar amount, a bigger percentage of the bill than at the other schools where she got full tuition merit-based aid. And on top of that, Harvard offers loan packages that are equivalent to the federal loans. So it's just an incredible deal. And that contrast with what Harvard and other Ivy Leagues are offering, I think, is just unexpected and remarkable.
Thank you for your story, Tom, and good luck to your daughter. What instrument does she play, by the way?
A vocalist.
Oh, she's
and
a vocalist.
Composer.
I don't know why I assumed she played an instrument. Good luck to her, and thank you. I want to read actually a couple more comments from listeners because I think they hit on points that really need to be brought into the conversation here. Here's Owen in San Francisco who says, my son is an attorney with the ACLU based in New York. His wife is an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights. My son had a large scholarship at Penn intended to support public interest law, and yet he still has a large debt that he's been paying off for 10 years and will stretch on for years ahead. His wife has an enormous debt, much larger than his. Neither makes the kind of money that they might if they were defending Dow Chemical or white-collar criminals. The money they owe is the equivalent of a mortgage, but has prevented them from even considering ever buying a home or even having a child. The scandal of college loans will affect this country far into the future and will someday be recognized for the disaster it is. Can it ever be reformed? A very important point and question. And Danielle writes, I have $155,000 in both federal and private loans from putting myself through undergraduate and graduate schools. I now have a master's degree and a good job. But with paying $1,500 a month back to my loan providers, I'm living as a person making $7 to $10 an hour. What would help is giving people like me more opportunities to work in programs or companies that pay back your loans in exchange for work and a time commitment similar to an MHSA, that is a Mental Health Service Act program, or the programs here in California. Bring on more of your calls, and let's go to Charles. Charles, you're on.
Good morning. Senator Warren of Pennsylvania has a bill in the Senate that would tie education loan repayment rates to the same rate we loan money to banks at, which I believe is 0.9%. I'm just wondering why that doesn't get more attention. And second question, if bankruptcy judges, if bankruptcy courts were able to allow debtors to shed education loans, you know, what effect, if any, might that have, you know, on how these loans are structured or not capped in some cases?
Hi, they're both good questions. Andrew Gillen, want to go first here?
Yeah, so there were a few problems with Senator Warren's proposal. The first is that the 0.75 interest rate she was talking about was the Fed discount window, and that's an overnight rate. So those loans last basically one day, and there's never been a default on those loans. So the Fed always gets its money back, and that's why the interest rate is so low. When you look at student loans, those are loans for, you know, up to decades. And the default rate is currently 13.4%. So that's why student loans are going to need to have a much higher interest rate than the interest rate at the Fed discount window.
Actually, Debbie Cochran, Andrew Gillen in his work has red flagged colleges with high default rates, and you have some concern about the statistics or the numbers that he came up with? Because of students not even getting loans in some instances?
Yeah, I mean, I think when we're looking at student loan debt and borrowers and the implications for borrowers on all of these scores, I think we need to look at how likely students are to borrow in the first place. For instance, you know, we know that graduates with bachelor's degrees tend to leave school with just under $27,000 of debt on average, but about a third of students graduate with bachelor's degrees without any student loan debt at all. So that's a really important piece of this. So I think, you know, we often look at default rates and who's able to repay their loans and just kind of see these high rates, you know, at community colleges versus for-profit colleges, maybe see them as equivalent, but in fact, they represent far different, scopes of problems at the two sectors because so few students at community colleges do borrow.
Comment from you on that, Andrew Gillen, before I go to more calls?
Yeah, so we did in the report, we did take into account the percent of students who are borrowing. And it showed up in one of the tables and one of the columns. Unfortunately, that didn't make it into a lot of the coverage of the report. But yeah, that's something we did take into account.
All right, let me take some more callers into account. Another caller named Kevin joining us. Good morning.
Good morning. How's it going?
It's going, as you hear.
I
never know how to answer that question, but go ahead.
I'm a high school teacher in San Francisco at a big comprehensive public high school, and for me, I went to UC Davis, so I'm a product of the public school system. When I went to school, it was $1,000 for 4 years of tuition after my Cal Grant A's. But I do see as a high school teacher a philosophical and a financial and a strategic kind of misplay. The philosophical idea that everybody needs to go to a four-year college is crippling the system because you have a lot of kids that are in the four-year system that don't really belong there. And then the strategic way to handle that, I think, is more vocational stuff tied in with, specific programs in high school that lead into, say, a San Francisco City College associate's degree in welding or in carpentry or in plumbing. And that will reduce the amount of people that end up at a four-year college that don't really want to be there. And then for that to happen, I think strategically, the state of California or public funding, they need to really invest in places like City College and community-based colleges to be able to offload, you know, tens if not hundreds of thousands of students from the state and UC system, because if they're getting a quality two-year certificate which leads to a job at a junior college, they don't need to go to four-year college to get work. They don't need to go to graduate school for work, which then, you know, creates kind of an upward trickle effect of lessening the financial burden of having so many students with so much need.
Kevin, you raised some good points and important points. There's a third caller or emailer that we've had saying maybe college isn't for everybody and we need alternatives. But notwithstanding somebody like Edward Snowden, who didn't have a high school diploma, who was making a fairly substantial salary, I mean, the economic forces, not to mention status and prestige, I mean, the statistics are there, Debbie Cochran. You can make a much higher income if you have a college degree. And it becomes often just a union card to get a job.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a premium to getting a college degree. There's also a premium to getting an associate's degree and many certificates. Vocational certificates can be just just as lucrative for students as an associate's or even a bachelor's degree in some cases. You know, I'm not sure if I would really think that there is a problem of a lot of students ending up, at least in California, in four-year institutions without really wanting to be there. I think we as a state have a policy of shifting 2/3 of all of our undergraduate students to the community colleges where they have a whole host of options. I mean, they could get their associates, they can transfer, but they also could get any number, you know, any more than 100 or 200 types of vocational credentials. And, you know, I think a bigger problem is that too many students who actually want a four-year degree go to the community colleges because they have to, and there's no space in the 4 years, and then they can't get out.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. I want to thank you, Debbie Cochran, from the Institute for College Access and Success. Thanks also to David Alcocer, who's also here with us in studio, who directs student financial support for the Office of the President at UC. And thanks to Andrew Gillen, who joined us from Washington, D.C., Research Director with the Education Sector, and Joshua Friedman, who joined us earlier on, Policy Analyst in the Economic Growth Program for the New America Foundation. And thanks to all of you. We wouldn't be here without you. We want to also remind you the forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg and Susan Britton. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks and Chad McIamans. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, executive producer Raul Ramirez. Our interns, Keelan Cronin, Usala Esanipour, Evelyn Wang, Jonathan Tam, and Max Walker Silverman. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.